Simplicity Parenting. It's a book, it's a movement, and if you think it's an oxymoron, you're probably in the bigger club. But today's guest, Kim John Payne, wrote that book and is very definitely making headway in a direction that is making sense to people all over the world. He speaks to educators worldwide, trains parents and teachers, has been a school counselor and education researcher. He's here today. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Kim, what happened that you found yourself in the position that you are today? Was it a mapped out course you planned, or a very definite crossroads or 90 degree turn you took one day?
Well, no, it was a bit of a combination of all those things, actually, because I found myself at a fairly young age working in group homes with violent offending kids, and I, but at the same time, was hearing and taking courses at university and actually studying the whole emerging issue of trauma and stress in combat veterans, and yet it seemed to me that the very same symptoms were occurring to the kids that I was working with in the group home. And then later on, I traveled to Southeast Asia, and I was working there in refugee camps, in the Thai Cambodian refugee camps. And there again, I was seeing all the symptoms of what we now know as post-traumatic stress disorder. Only, you know, it was supposed to only apply to combat veterans. So, you know, it was a question of sort of just travel and being very, very interested in this. I became very interested in this theme of stress in childhood. And where the real aha moment came, when the wake-up call came, was when I was, again, just in a regular counseling practice. And this was west of London. And yet I was seeing all the same signs of nervous, hyper-vigilant, jumpy, over-controlling type of kids. Only these kids were just from fairly normal backgrounds. And I came to think of it as the undeclared war on childhood, actually.
Yeah, well, that really does feed into my next question. Knowing that you literally do work and travel worldwide, what do you think are the underlying symptoms now that you've described it as the, what did you say, the undercover or unknown war of children?
Yeah, the undeclared war of children.
Right,
yeah.
Now that you've mentioned it as the undeclared war of children, what underlying symptoms? It's human malpractice that you're seeing in an ongoing epidemic.
Well, you know, I think we're living now in a post-excess culture. We know now what excess does. We know what excess does to our planet. We know what excess has done to our economy. Many people now are beginning to understand what excess is doing into our education system, with high stakes testing and what I like to call the No Child Left Intact Act.
Well said.
More and more parents are becoming aware of and looking for other ways to how to work with all the pressures of the post-excess culture as it's affected our families, because this too much, too fast, too soon, you know, too quick, too sexy, too young. It's really had a fairly dramatic effect on our family life. And I think more and more parents now are saying, enough, there has to be another way.
Wonderfully said. And Kim, I really love that you called our culture the post-excess culture, because I feel like that's allowing for looking even more widely into what's going on. I feel like, you know, as you state in your website, one of your websites, that your work focuses on deepening understanding and giving practical tools for life that arise out of burning social issues of our time. But it seems that once an issue is recognized, what we are experiencing is actually the effects of a previous social issue. So there's a trick to seeing and really seeing and taking enough in to beat it to the punch, so to speak.
Yeah, the you know, it's a kind of a it's not so easy in some ways, because, you know, when, for example, it's got to do with how we do things, not necessarily what we're doing. And what I mean by this is that, for example, when we recycle our plastics and glass and so on, do we recycle out of a panic and out of an anxiety of what we're doing to the planet, or do we recycle out of a calmer space which has a real care for the earth? And similarly, when we start wanting to when we start wanting to find alternatives to our family life, do we do it out of a sense of panic, or do we do it out of a sense of reverence for childhood, and in a sense try and find a way out of this fever pitched life that many families have used to come to think of as normal, because that very, very fast-paced family life, it used to be that it was just so ubiquitous that people just stopped noticing it for a long time now, that it became the new normal. And what maybe about 15 years ago, what I was experiencing is, when I was talking about this, it was a little bit counterculture, actually, to talk about that this is just way too much for our families to cope with. Whereas now, this is really becoming a mainstream question, and more families and parents, as well as economists, as well as environmentalists, and, you know, people are even looking at this whole post-access culture now in terms of technology. There's hardly a day goes by in one of our major newspapers and magazines where articles about digital overload, or what I think of as digital detox, how do we detox, and articles of real concern about how technology is actually moving us away from connection and not moving us to connection, that technology is becoming pseudo-connection. And there have been voices raised, you know, for years about this, but now it's becoming a very central question of our time, which is very hopeful.
Well, you were just talking about the high-tech childhoods and the high-tech lives that all of us are living. Obviously, it's something that is here to stay. So, you know, it's not, I know my experience sometimes with, you know, a lot of people, they want to, oh, we need to go back to simpler times. Well, that's not going to happen. So we need to start from here. I mean, there must be an element that we can sort of appreciate and see and then move on from there. And I know this is the whole thrust of what you're doing. So I don't know, with the development of the high tech, what correlation do you see between this time spent watching a TV or a computer or texting? It's not really a connection. It's a pseudo connection. And then with the development of the eye, the personality, the individual.
Well, you know, I'm not in and I appreciate that, Robert. I'm not in any way suggesting that we go back in time. Technology is here to stay. It's for me, it's a question of how do we develop resilience for our children, so that they can actually cope with it. And the way to develop resilience is to give children a balance, so that there are parts of their lives where, and particularly, you know, screen media, you know, TVs and computers and phones and so on. I just think of it as screen, as screens. They are everywhere. They are absolutely everywhere. They're in gas stations. They're in libraries. They're in schools. They're in, you know, they are totally everywhere in a child's life. And so my advice to most parents is, just like everything else needs a balance, like exercise, eating and exercise needs balance, like waking and sleeping, sleep time you know, needs balance. What I suggest is, we used to be really radical, and more people are not thinking it's so radical anymore. But what I'm suggesting is that because screens and technology is a very, very pervasive in our society, that we set up our homes screen-free, that we use our homes as a place where, because it's the only thing basically within our control. We can't control that there are screens everywhere else, but we can control our homes. And if we want to have balance, then in my home, we just don't have televisions. We don't have the children having exposure to screens at all, because they, as soon as they step outside the home, there is so many screens in their lives. I think the Kaiser Family Foundation study, which was released a few months ago now and was widely reported in almost all the major newspapers that I saw, gave us the figure that children between the age of 8 and 18 now, the daily average is 7.5 hours in front of a screen per day. Now, that in itself is disturbing, but the what really caught my attention was that back in 2005, the average was, I think it was 4.75. So if you do the math on that, 4.75 hours a day up to 7.5 hours a day, you do the math on that, and it gets very, very concerning. So my advice to parents is, get some balance in your child's life, and don't rely on society to do that. We can be in charge of that by having our homes be a digital oasis.
That's very true. That's very, very true, and that's a wonderful solution to this, to one of the problems going on here. I know you've also done a lot of work internationally looking at traditions regarding rites of passage for adolescents, and do you think that because of the problems that are going on, or do you think it's more cultural, or do you think there is truly... is there a lack of rites of passage, or is it possible as a human race we've outgrown these rites of passages? I can't imagine a tribal girl or boy living maybe, you know, in northern Thailand or Africa or somewhere. I mean, some of those rites of passage were, you know, I would use the word primitive there, that they cut them or, you know, have to go through these really strange...
Personally witnessed three rites of passage for young boys in some very, very remote areas in the world. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting with rites of passage is that in very traditional tribal structures, you've got a lot of form. It's a very, very structured society, you know. They have very, very structured coming of age rites of passage, and in a society like ours, which is much, much less structured, it makes sense that our rites of passage are altogether different. But one of the things that and I've even spoken to tribal elders about this in Africa and Asia, who have been just good enough to sit with me and talk about these things, but the hopeful point for me is that I don't think rites of passage have gone anywhere. I think they're absolutely still with us, and they're still with every child. But they've changed, and they've kind of metamorphosed. And what happens is the easiest way that I can understand this is that rites of passage for thousands of years have always been designed to help young children come into a new sense of responsibility, but also a new sense of freedom, and a kind of an overarching sense of who they are. You know, so now I'm not a child anymore. Who am I in this community? It's sort of it's a self-definition process, is one way to think of it. Now, I think kids are still absolutely going through rites of passage, but they're doing it through relationship. They're doing it through intensity of relationship. They're doing it through what you could call I sometimes think of it as like a new rite of passage of intense human encounter. And they're looking for intensity in relationship, because when you have, and I think one of the biggest ones is conflict, because when you have conflict and difficult times, and you as a child, and you've got to work things out, then a tremendous amount of self-definition occurs, but it's not just done in one big outer ceremony. It's happening much more slowly, much less defined on a day-to-day basis. But the problem with this, actually, Robin, is that, you know, if conflict and intense human relationship is a new rite of passage, we've got a bit of a problem with technology, because technology is setting up pseudo-relationships, not real relationships, and they're leading our kids away from knowing who they are and coming into real relationships. That's one of my real concerns with social networking. Is I talk to kids all the time about how can you turn social networking into social activism, into real activism, and into what you want to do in the world and what you stand for. And you know, if intense human relationship is becoming a new way that we define ourselves, another problem that we've got in the West is that we're largely conflict aversive. You know, we want every day to be a kind of crystal rainbow or a balancing experience. And if there's struggle, then it's bad. If joy, then, well, that's good. But struggle and conflict, that seems to be bad. And my work a lot with schools and with parents, and I work in this with whole schools, whole school districts and private schools and so on, is to try and set up a way that we elder our children through their conflicts. When they're having conflicts, we try and strike this balance between micromanaging and not allowing them to come into conflict.
Right, it's like,
that's bad.
We're going to
separate
you.
But on the other hand,
you.
Not stepping back so far that they get really badly emotionally hurt. And so I think the rites of passage, coming of age, is still very, very firmly with us, only it doesn't exist just in outer ceremony anymore.
Well, it seems from what you're saying, it just feels to me like there's almost a new element of rites of passage being led by peers rather than your adults, your family, or your community, or your spiritual centers.
If we step back and create a vacuum, then you almost have like an inversion of rites of passage, where you have kids trying to lead kids through it. It's almost like a sort of a Lord of the Flies scene.
I was just thinking that.
You know, it's an inverted rite of passage, and it doesn't. For thousands and thousands of years, rites of passage have been led by elders, and my question is, if intense human relationships and really active human relationships are a way that we define ourselves now, the question has got to be, who are the new tribal elders? I mean, who is eldering this? And the kind of troubling answer to that is actually it's us. And we know, you know, all our own inadequacies as parents. We really do know this, but nevertheless, there is, I think, a way in which we can feel ourselves to be more or less worthy of helping our kids through their difficulties and through their conflicts and their struggles. And the simple way to do that is that we have to be doing it ourselves. You know, we, as Gandhi said, we
perfectly
have
said.
To become the change we wish to see, which,
yes.
you know, is a bit of a drag, really, isn't it? That, you know, we have to.
I don't know.
Actually,
I think it's kind of a fun
trip. We actually
trip.
Have to do it. But and I don't mean getting it right and being perfect, but that struggle to be social beings ourselves, to take responsibility for our relationships when we get it wrong and be willing to step up and try and put it right. I think our kids, more and more kids are able to see now into that. They're it's not like they're clairvoyant, it's like they're clairsentient.
Exactly.
They get right into our feeling life. And we just can't fake kids out anymore. And I think to be that elder of our kids, that guide, that mentor of our children, it's no more than just a path of self-development as a parent.
Well, we can't stop. You know, you can't just become a parent and then stop in your own development. I mean, of course, as any therapist knows, they every day have to call themselves or recognize their own garbage, their own stuff, if they're going to be any kind of a therapist. And certainly the same thing goes on that parental level. But the interesting thing that you're making me think about is, you know, I feel like my parents and the way I grew up, they were still caught up in society's mores. You know, they had morals that society sort of spoke to and about, and you sort of lived within certain boundaries. And yet they raised children like me who really grew up where that was over. You know, the 60s and 70s were happening, and that just was not the case anymore. So, you know, it makes it difficult for that parent to parent someone going through life really on another planet, almost, to know the right answers.
Isn't it interesting, the 60s and 70s, there was something that really started to shift. You know, previously, a lot of the way we parented, for example, and the way we ran politics and the way we ran our local governments was all about the way it was done before, albeit with small, you know, individualized changes. But, you know, for example, with parenting, it's probably the best example, is that our grandparents were parented just the way in which their parents were, and their parents were, and there was a tradition which held the way things were done. You know, if, like my grandmother, she grew up on the west coast of Scotland, you know, and well, that's where her parents were, and there was just no question that if a young girl, for example, became, let's say, like pregnant at the age of 15, then there would be the priest or the society with the community would step right in and tell you exactly what was going to happen, and likewise issues around how to die, about death, and there was no question. But these big questions around birth and death, now there are options, there are all kinds of thoughts, there are all kinds of choices that we make around that now. And so we're living in this time where we're in a sense in a cusp, because we're in one way we could say we're bereft of the old social structures that guided us from the past, but we're marvelously free. We are just wonderfully free to make our own decisions. And there's just one more step in this, is that, okay, so the old communities that we were born into are gone. And we could say, well, then in some ways, the only thing we have in common now is we have nothing in common, actually. But now we strive to find our community through consciousness, through choice. Now it's a question of choice. It's not a question of where you're born and the structures that you inherited. Now we build our own structures. And I find this moving around the world, that it's not just a North American thing that's happening, that's going on. This is happening in the so-called developing world, in the second world, in the first world. This question of how do we now define how we want to live as individuals is a burning question all around the world, and the rubber hits the road of that in our families. It's very, very intense in our families, because when things go wrong, grandma and grandpa just aren't around anymore. And even if they were, as they are some kids, they can only advise. They can't really govern as our extended family used to.
Right. You know, when you were talking about making this change and living through choice, and you mentioned the word consciousness, I feel like this is, I see the perfection in it, in that, you know, now we have this freedom of choice that's just making everyone sort of crazy. You know, everything's to the nth degree. The limits are just being pushed in every direction. And that's what it's taking, obviously, to start becoming and making choice through, you know, we won't be making it through choice, but we will be making it through consciousness. It's leading up to that. I just feel it.
Yet, isn't that interesting that so much of this now has to do with being very conscious of our actions, and you know, and we see all around the world the results of when we become less conscious, you know, or when we try and go back into the past, because the future looking, the future direction is all about that being conscious of our actions. But if we try and just recreate what was happening in the past, where we try and go back into our unconscious ethnic stream, then we see things like Rwanda, we see things like the Balkans, we see, it's just, admittedly, you know, we have to be conscious of our ethnic roots, but in a way in which the individual starts to think about that and make a relationship for him or herself. And every time we try and go backwards into the way it used to be, what happens is fundamentalism. What happens is whenever we retreat, the implications of that for society usually are quite dramatic, even terrible. And so that wanting to become conscious, wanting to move forward, wanting to find communities of consciousness, and I don't mean just sort of places where we retreat into. I mean, really, that consciousness has got to do with how a lot of that is how do we treat each other? Do we? It's what I think of as are we willing to live in that kind of respectful engagement? We stay engaged, but we stay respectful. We avoid blaming. We avoid shaming of other people as much as we possibly can, and live on that edge. Otherwise, we start seeking what I think of as escape routes. And one of the major escape routes is addiction. And we've been talking about technology, but I the way I define addiction is that it's an increasing and compulsive, almost like a gesture to replace inner development by creating outer stimulation.
Come on back next week for the conclusion of our discussion with Kim John Payne, author of Simplicity Parenting. And there's a website with the same name, simplicityparenting.com. For any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.org. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.